Civic Flame, a podcast where we take a look at the U.S. Constitution and how it is, or isn't, shaping the government today. I'm your host, Amber Veo, and I'm a professor of law and policy at Worcester State University. I'm very excited to talk to you today about Article 2 of the Constitution, because the presidency is such a good example of how the Constitution is not self-enforcing, and people come to think about what the Constitution is by what they see going on, and not by forcing people to obey what the Constitution actually says. What does this all mean? Well, if you tuned in last week, you already know a little bit. But mostly, it means that the office of the president, no matter who the president is at the time, has way more power than the Constitution ever intended. And that can work in good, think mobilization during World War II, and bad, think Japanese internment during World War II, ways. Last week, we did a campfire episode and then took a break for Thanksgiving. But the week before that, we talked about some structural stuff with the Constitution, particularly Article 2 and the presidency. This week, we're going to get into Article 2, Sections 2 through 4. My favorite constitutional website, the National Constitution Center, is down today. So I'm turning to my second favorite constitutional resource online and my favorite online legal resource, Cornell Law School. If you're ever looking for legal stuff online, the National Constitution Center is very readable and easily accessible. But for those deeper dives, the Legal Information Institute at law.cornell.edu is top tier. For those of you preparing for the LSAT or thinking about going to law school or in law school, if you don't already know about this resource, get yourself over there. It's going to be good for you. Otherwise, let's go into the presidency. Remember how Article 1 was in 10 sections and it took us months to get through? Yep. That's because Congress, Article 1, was meant to have all the powers in the system. Today, we're going through Sections 2 through 4 of Article 2, and that will end our look at Article 2 because there's not more. The presidency was never supposed to be very powerful, but let's take a look at what the president can do. Section 2 starts with, "The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militias of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States." This is the one we're most familiar with, and it does a few things. One is that it gives the false illusion that the president makes decisions to go to war. Remember, under our constitutional authority, at least, it's Congress's power to declare war, not the president. But because of the commander-in-chief power, and because of the rise in presidential war powers broadly, the presidency has taken a lot more power than the Constitution intends. And notice that I'm saying the presidency rather than any specific president, because the problem is bipartisan. It crosses generations, it crosses political parties, and the power that stays with the office is regardless of who takes them in the first place. So it doesn't matter which president takes any power. What matters is that whoever comes next is going to have that power and try to take more. The other thing that this section notes is the, quote, militia. Today we would consider that the National Guard. Remember, at the founding, we didn't really have a standing army, and a standing army was not common until after World War II, at least not a big, professional, easy to mobilize one that we would recognize today. So, if somebody wanted to saddle up, they basically had to build the army first. This meant that for many states, especially as states were expanding west and, you know, meeting resistance from the indigenous people we were kicking off of their land, the biggest defenses were what we would today consider the National Guard. And all states today have National Guards. You know, in case Wisconsin tries to invade the Upper Peninsula or Michiganders have to hold them off until the feds get there. But Section 2 also allows the president to federalize the National Guard. This was a bit of a big deal during the early 2000s when National Guard units were being sent to Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the key problems with the response to Hurricane Katrina was actually that a lot of the Louisiana National Guard was deployed overseas instead of where they were meant to be to help their own people. There was also an issue of something called stop-lossing, in which the government prevented people who had completed their military service or contracts and tried to keep them around. But that's a different discussion. But because the president can direct the military and is the commander-in-chief, it does give people the wrong impression that war powers are strictly a presidential thing and are supposed to be a presidential thing, which, as you now know, is not true. It's a Congress thing. Anytime the president takes too much power in war, yeah, we can blame the president a little bit, but we should really blame Congress for not holding them accountable. Other specific presidential powers include cool stuff like asking for memos. He may require the opinion in writing of the principal officer of each of the executive departments upon any subject relating to the duties of their respective offices. Yeah, okay, it's not ideal, but this does help establish all of that executive branch bureaucracy that we've talked about before. So, like your cabinet department, your Department of Defense, your Department of Housing and Urban Development, and so on. Next, Article 2, Section 2 says, "And he shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for all offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment." This one gives you two things. One, the Constitution was really serious about the House having the sole power over impeachment. Even a presidential pardon cannot change that. Two, the pardon power. This is a big deal and has typically gone through processes with the Department of Justice. We can talk later about presidents who have used this power properly and those who have not, but pardon power is a big executive power, and even the executive of states, also known as governors, have this power. But the key here is the president can only pardon people for federal crimes. This is what it means when it says crimes against the United States, rather than state crimes. The next section basically sets up all of those confirmation hearings that we see going on when somebody gets nominated to the Supreme Court or a new president comes in and tries to get their cabinet set up. He shall have the power, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, to make treaties, provided 2/3 of the senators present concur, and he shall nominate and, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors, other public ministers, consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States, whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law, but the Congress may, by law, vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the President alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments. This gives you a couple things. One, you'll want to remember the U.S. Code that we talked about before, and you can go to law.cornell.edu and look up the U.S. Code, and it will show you the different ways this has been put into practical practice rather than simply all of these kind of big, vague, broad things that the Constitution says. Two, you'll notice that there are some offices that people who are the head of departments can fill, some offices that the president can fill without the advice and consent of the Senate, and some offices that members of the courts can fill. So it doesn't mean that everybody who works for the federal government has to be appointed or approved by the president or Congress. In fact, many people who work for the federal government are not political operatives at all. They're just people who, yeah, sure, have political preferences, but also are experts in their field or just are working a job. So what you see here are two things. The president has a lot of the diplomacy and foreign relation powers. And two, the Senate is a pretty big check on the president. But sometimes this goes sideways, like Senator Mitch McConnell refusing to hold confirmation hearings for Merrick Garland because Obama only had 9 months left in office. But then Senator Mitch McConnell pushed Amy Coney Barrett through her confirmation hearing when the 2020 election had already started and Trump had only a few weeks left in office. We'll talk another time about the politicization of these confirmation hearings. But for now, just know that this is another one of those parts of our checks and balances system, and sometimes it works well, and sometimes it does not. But then you get to the recess appointments, which gives the president the power to put someone in a job if Congress is not showing up for work. The president shall have the power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions, which shall expire at the end of next session. Section 3 sets up the State of the Union, some procedural stuff. He shall from time to time give the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall deem necessary and expedient. And there's more procedural stuff, but then we get to the important part. He may, on extraordinary occasion, convene both houses or either of them, and in cases of disagreement between them, with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he thinks shall be proper. He shall receive ambassadors and other public ministers. That's more of your diplomatic powers. Then you get the real big one. He shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed and shall commission all the officers of the United States. When you hear about the take care clause, this is what people are talking about. As the executive, the president must execute the job. So the president is required to take care that the laws are observed. It's interesting to see that so many of the president's powers are not so much powers as they are obligations. And I think it's an important difference between the presidency and Congress in our system. The president is a guard to make sure the laws are faithfully executed, but Congress gets to make those laws. And in the same vein, the final section of Article 2 says, "The president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors," really emphasizing that there are major constraints on this office, or at least there are supposed to be. So it's important to note the ways in which U.S. presidents have reshaped the role of the office itself. Through getting the White House, Air Force One, the motorcade, having the ability to stand up in front of any microphone, and as importantly, being a single person rather than 535 members of Congress, the president has the illusion of more power, or in some cases, the reality of more power, because the illusion has been used to create the reality. This is something political scientists refer to as the single mover advantage. This happens because of the ideas of what people think the president should be, but also it allows Congress to abdicate their responsibility. People in Congress who like the president ride on the president's coattails while being able to distance themselves from criticism, while those who oppose the president can criticize the president's policies without ever having to propose legislation or fight with their colleagues. So as George Carlin would say, business as usual in the United States. Not to be too cynical about it, but when Congress fails to do its job, this is what happens. And sooner or later, it's going to put a big burden on the political and legal system of the United States. Well, that's it for Article 2. Can you believe it? Just wait until we get to Article 3 next time. In the meantime, share widely and follow us at Dr. Fun Sponge on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Substack. As we move into the holiday season, we'll be taking shorter breaks coming towards the middle of December. In the meantime, take care out there and keep the civic flame burning bright. The Civic Flame is a Dr. Fun Sponge Media production in coordination with writer Amber Veo and Matthew Munyon, sound producer. As always, thank you for listening.